You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Dan.
Hi, Bob.
How you doing?
Doing pretty well.
Okay, let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. You're Dan Hendricks, director of the Center for AI Safety, and I would say a kind of important figure in AI generally and AI research as well. And we're going to talk about a very interesting paper that you've co-authored with Eric Schmidt, former CEO of Google, of course, and Alexander Wang, CEO of Scale AI. And the paper is called Super Intelligence Strategy. I'm really looking forward to this. Both because I'm going to give you a little pushback, I think, which is always fun and sometimes constructive. And because I think this is just about the most important subject in the world, which is how to keep AI from wreaking havoc. Let me say a little bit more about you. I mentioned that you're an important figure in AI research. Among other things, you co-authored a paper on what you called representation engineering, which was one of the first attempts to not just find out how concepts are represented within large language models, but even manipulate them in ways that change the model's output. We've seen a little more research on that since then, but that was kind of a pioneering paper. You're also known because you were behind this statement. I mean, your Center for AI Safety that got a lot of attention in 2023. And it was very simple. It said mitigating the risk of extinction from AI should be a global priority alongside other societal scale risks, such as pandemics and nuclear war. Got a lot of sign on. I mean, Sam Altman signed on, and I don't know, you know better than I didn't. Several CEOs of big, probably Sundar Pichai, I would guess, and who else? I don't know.
Yeah, Demis, the CEO of DeepMind, the CEO of Anthropic, Jeffrey Hinton, Yasha Bengio, lots of Daniel Dennett, lots of academics. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well done. I'm a little offended that I wasn't asked to sign, but it's fine. this superintelligence strategy thing. Now, you cover a lot of ground here. I think one of the most interesting things, and a thing you emphasize in it, is this concept of mutually assured AI malfunction, MAIM, which you're saying is in some ways, certainly not all, analogous to mutually assured destruction in the context of nuclear weapons, which, however grim it sounds, is thought of as a stabilizing force because each side knows that if it launches a nuclear attack, there's a pretty good chance that its country gets incinerated. So I want to talk about that. Would you say that's almost the central concept in the paper, a central new concept in the paper, I guess?
Yeah, I think we'll try and tackle all the classic questions like what do we do about AI and ethics, like what value systems we put into them, and what do we do about lethal autonomous weapons? We'll try and touch on each of those because I think that there are reasonable answers to those longstanding questions, and we'll try and compile them. But I think the main part of the strategy is deterrence between superpowers for building destabilizing projects. There's technically three branches in the strategy. There's deterrence, there's non-proliferation, and there is competitiveness, where states need to increase their, things like improve their, supply of drones or their supply of AI chips and make it have a more secure supply chain for that. But I think that the main, the thing that's more novel than all the rest would certainly be the point about superpowers deterring each other from pursuing destabilizing AI projects.
Okay. So let me quote from the paper. The idea here is that any state's aggressive bid for unilateral AI dominance would be met with preventive sabotage by rivals. This is like a key dynamic in this mutually assured AI malfunction thing. And then you say, given the relative ease of sabotaging a destabilizing AI project through interventions ranging from covert degradation, training, and so on, MAME, you know, mutually assured malfunction, already describes the strategic picture AI superpowers find themselves in. Before we drill down on that, would you talk about an aggressive bid for unilateral AI dominance? I guess a key question is what constitutes that? I mean, you talk, AI has obvious military uses, but I don't think that's the only dimension by which, along which a state could seek AI dominance in a way another state could find threatening, right? And obviously, look, the subtext, let's get it out. We're talking about the U.S. and China more than we're talking about any other two nations right now, because they are the two AI superpowers and they are currently in a pretty antagonistic relationship.
Yeah, so I think this is partly describing the future when AI is more common knowledge, when the states are seeing, oh my goodness, there are these AIs that can automate mid-level engineers. That might happen this year, for instance. And so I think this is kind of describing the situation that we'll find ourselves in soon. So although they have the ability to sabotage each other right now, they don't see a reason. It's not close enough to that yet. And it's not common knowledge that, oh, we need to be really laser focused on each other's AI projects, in particular, the ones that could allow one to leapfrog the other and completely crush the other. So, but that like a super intelligence could have that property of either enabling one state to crush the other, or maybe in the process of developing it, they lose control of it. Either way, it's very concerning to other states. And it's not just the U.S. and China here. Russia. Let's imagine Russia ends the conflict with Ukraine so soon. Then they're thinking about what's going on, and they're seeing these tremendous advances in AI later this year. And we're totally behind. We don't have any AI chips. We have nothing. We will lose unless we co-opt or sabotage other sorts of projects. It doesn't need to be the projects right now, but the ones that look more destabilizing, ones that are actual bids for superintelligence, which are a little bit down the road.
Okay. So you said we're not quite there yet, where one of these major states is in an aggressive bid for unilateral AI dominance. That's one thing I'd question from the get-go. I would think certainly from China's point of view, the U.S. is staging an aggressive bid for unilateral AI dominance. And let me just flesh that out. So as you know, we've got a pretty strict, well, we're trying to make it as strict as possible, as little leakage as possible, ban on the import by China of the most advanced AI chips, the most advanced AI equipment. I think you support that. I know your co-authors do, and maybe to varying degrees, but I think you support that. And, you know, surrounding that, I mean, first of all, that alone, if the things that, you know, everyone says are true, which is that AI is kind of central to future economic dominance and future military dominance, I'm not sure why China wouldn't see that alone as an aggressive bid for unilateral AI dominance. Moreover, a lot of people are saying that. Dario Amodai, how do you pronounce his last name? I'll forget.
Amodai, yeah.
Amodai. You know, head of Anthropic, one of the three big makers of proprietary AI LLMs in the U.S., and a really big figure in AI in his own right, you know, very recently, as you know, published this thing where he just said, look, the goal is for the West to dominate the world as long as we can. We cut off their chip supply. So he is saying, China, you should now perceive, as I understand it, you know, that the U.S. is in an aggressive bid for unilateral AI dominance. And there's been a lot of talk. I mean, in fact, look, one of your co-authors, Alexander Wang, right after the DeepSeek model was released, took out a full page ad in the Washington Post. That said, we must win this AI war or something, clearly talking about China. So, you know, why? And of course, it's all about perception. I mean, during, you know, with MAD, it wasn't just that each player wouldn't launch a nuclear strike. They also wouldn't do something that they thought would be mistaken for a nuclear strike. So they respected that it was all about perception. So why? It seems to me, MAME has already failed. I mean, we are not, the U.S. is not being deterred by fear of Chinese sabotage, right?
Mm-hmm. So this is a great, great collection of points. So I think that there aren't any destabilizing projects being run where like this would in potentially a short period of time in some few months get you a super intelligence that could happen later this year. I think as well, things like export controls, we're mainly advocating for knowing where the chips are reliably and preventing smuggling to rogue actors. In the competitiveness section, we describe that if states are wanting to be competitive, one way is to try and have more export controls and do a zero-sum competition over AI chips. But that would be just for a competitiveness thing. That wouldn't be necessary for survival. Mm-hmm. I think that the thing, these statements about AI are like, people are kind of listening to them, mostly not. Sort of like in the US, if you ask people like, do you support stronger AI regulation, all this sort of stuff, they say yes, bipartisan, overwhelming. But it's not that salient of an issue. And likewise, I think in the National Security Council, at the Politburo, AI is also not that salient of an issue. And the existing export controls are maybe registered as, like, say, a 3 out of 10 in terms of pain for China. So if that were a much higher amount, and if they were seeing more economic impacts from AI, and the prospect of how it could be more immediately destabilizing or soon to be destabilizing, when that's more foreseeable, then I think this comes into the picture more and becomes more common knowledge. So they have the capability to do this sabotage, though. But in terms of it being an I know that you know, this sort of thing that MAD requires, that is modeling each other's expectations and mutually constraining each other's intent, that hasn't kicked in yet. And so that's partly what the paper intends to do, is to make it more common knowledge that this is how some states will very likely, these are their incentives, and this is how they'll be thinking about each other's programs.
And I should say, I don't think you're saying this is as naturally stabilizing as MAD was. And you propose doing some things that would make it more stabilizing. But back to the question of whether we are doing things that naturally lead to the perception in China of an aggressive bid for AI dominance. You're saying, when you say it's not really central to people's consciousness right now, you're saying even in Beijing, you think they're not thinking a lot about this? Because I would think that's quite an indictment of their intelligence. I mean, in the sense of IQ, less their intelligence apparatus. But, you know, it's not rocket science.
It's understandable, though. I think when people are thinking through the implications, they don't really know what to do. And so there'll be an AI advancement. They'll think through the implications for like a week or two. It's really difficult. There's not clarity. They'll say, we'll just wait and see for more of the strategic picture and the basic variables to come into play, because it's too hard to have foresight and it's too depressing to think about. And then they'll put their heads back in the sand. But I think this will just be harder to do for people later on. For some people, it's easier to do, and some people are still getting around to thinking about AI and its implications for the first time. So, but I think it's totally understandable, because you have to, you know, shift your, you know, it's an ontological rewrite in your head that, oh my goodness, maybe actually the next decade is extremely relevant. Maybe life will be totally different thereafter. So it requires a fairly different skill set. But I think as the economic implications start becoming more obvious when AIs get more powerful, then the gravity of the situation will be more apparent. And then this is how I think that they would end up responding.
Yeah. Now you said something about, you said we're not to superintelligence yet. And you said something about something that was possible later this year. So, I mean, do you mean superintelligence? You mean AGI? You mean what?
So, because,
go ahead.
There's the path, or a path to a superintelligence. Probably the most plausible one is if you get AIs that can automate basically all of AI research, and then you can create you know, 10,000, 100,000, run as many of them as you want of these world-class AI researchers simultaneously that are artificial and they're operating 100x the speed of humans. That process, you could expect to have, you know, maybe a decade's worth of developments in half a year or something. So you could have some substantial leapfrogging once you get to that level. If you're able to remove the human friction and make things go from human level speeds to machine level speeds in terms of research. Right. So that I think is a destabilizing type of project. We don't have that yet because we don't have that level of automation. It seems very plausible to me we'll get a lot closer there this year with substantial advancements in AI automating parts of software engineering. I don't know if it would do it wholesale. I would guess it's more likely than not that it won't get there by the end of the year. But the year after, it's a lot more plausible. And that's when they'll need to start. Really be signaling their intent to, you don't do that destabilizing AI project or else I will prevent you from doing so.
Yeah. I mean, you've referred to the scenario, which is pretty common in like AI visionary circles. And I think was central to this situational awareness paper, which is part of this whole logic behind export controls, which is that, you know, there's this accelerating curve, right? And so you get to AGI, artificial general intelligence, defined in various ways. But the idea is that not long thereafter, there could be this so-called intelligence explosion. So then the curve really steepens and you're moving into superintelligence territory. So I would think if you buy that, and many people in America buy it, including a number of people who are advocating these export controls, the time for China to act is now. If they're going to sabotage the program, because we're hearing from serious people, yeah, we could have AGI by the end of the year. Well, you know, by some accounts, superintelligence is like a nanosecond after AGI.
I think it may be some months.
If you were Xi Jinping, wouldn't you think it's time to start the sabotage?
I don't know if I would probably be signaling that if you start having much more automation of AI research, once that progress bar gets further, then you could expect direct threats not to do something, not to make an attempt for unilateral dominance or a strategic monopoly on power. Would use that to crush us, and second, you might lose control of the project as well. In which case, everybody's killed. So it's extraordinarily risky. That's not okay. But I don't know if now would necessarily be the time. I should also mention that the export controls part, there are other reasons people could be into export controls. So if you're thinking of this sort of mutual deterrence picture, if you're on Team United States, you still may want the export controls, not necessarily to limit China's capabilities. That might be a lot harder to do. They could always just like steal the model from you. But if you could have much more AI chips relative to them, this could substantially improve your economic competitiveness. Because in the future, if you have lots of AI agents running around and they're doing a lot of the economic work, if you're able to run 10 million of these AI agents and China's only able to run, you know, 10,000, then you have a much more competitive economy. So even if you're like in a situation as the US was with Russia, where we have deterrence, but then we also have containment of the Soviet Union, and with China, it'd be, you know, deterrence and strategic competition, you still would want something like export controls for economic security reasons, but not necessarily for let's build a super intelligence to take over the world reasons.
And why does economic security demand that we dominate China economically?
It's not dominate. So China has other sorts of economic advantages in AI competition, such as they can have more energy. They may have more diffusion, so they may pump it throughout their economy more quickly. That's a bit more arguable. On other things, the US and China are tied, like on the ability or the algorithmic insights. There's a high sharing there, and on the data availability, they both have access to the internet, so they're pretty similar there. But the US's main advantage would be chips. So if they're trying to compete economically with China longer term, then that would be a way they could do so, is by making sure that they have more chips relative to China.
Okay, so your premise seems to be, look, we are in a cold war with China. It's going to be like the one with the Soviet Union. There's no going back. It's zero sum. Going to be a winner and a loser. We have to be the winner.
I mean, there was detente during the Cold War. It's eventually you may get out of it because AI might automate other parts of the economy. You haven't built a stable. You haven't pursued a destabilizing project where you try and get a superintelligence, or maybe you lose control of it in the process. But so you have other AIs, and those are automating parts of the economy, and the countries are getting rich, and that may create some spirit of detente. And then eventually they may decide to build a superintelligence slowly and carefully together, instead of trying to have a winner-take-all dynamic. I'm not necessarily foreseeing this as a multi-decade strategy. I think that the technical facts of the matter should be robust, maybe for at least foreseeably half a decade to a decade of buying time. But it's very possible that the deterrence wears in the late 2030s or something, and it doesn't work, and they have to do something different. But that's the way out of this. By default, they're preventing superintelligence, but they're getting AIs capable in lots of other economic domains, and they're competing with each other. Maybe they have less adversarial relations with each other in time because everybody's economy is doing so great. Nobody wants to get in any conflict or risk anything. And they want to get more economic benefits out of AI. But the only way they can do that is to build more capable systems somewhat gradually, with specified benefit sharing and things like that.
Okay. But do you agree that, if we accept your premise, which is that a rational actor should be expected, if faced with an aggressive bid for AI dominance, should be expected to try to sabotage the program, beginning with maybe covert means, but escalating to like bombing data centers? You see that as the
it's probably needless. I think cyber attacks would work well enough, but
okay. But if that's the case, do you think that people considering the merits of the chip wars should at least consider one downside of them being to make that kind of behavior by China more likely?
The sabotaging or the, I think the behavior,
yeah, sabotaging, for example, I mean, mm-hmm. if let me put it another way. It's like, you're saying we're not to super intelligence yet. So, we're not a month away, so they shouldn't yet consider it a bid for dominance, but by your own account, we're not, going to come. And so, if we persist in the policies that you favor, the chip restrictions, it's like in a year or so, if China is a rational actor, then by your account and Eric Schmidt's account and Alexander Wang's account, we mm-hmm. should expect them to declare like real kind of war on us and try to destroy our AI program. I mean, that's where the policies you favor are headed, naturally.
I don't think it's declaring war as much. I think even if we didn't have any export controls, which is, I think, totally, fortunately, the Department of Commerce was very prescient on this issue in focusing on AI chip export controls. But even if not, I still think it would be rational for them to sabotage. And it's not just China. China's not the only relevant actor here. We don't just need to model them. There are other states, such as Russia, which also would go, what's going on? This is, you might lose control of this thing, or you might use this to crush me. This isn't okay. Mm-hmm. So I think that the chip restrictions, which I think don't have the pain knob very high up even, particularly influence this deterrence picture. I do think that the export controls have turned all the way up. The pain is really high. And China is now, let's say, AGI pilled, that they're more foresightful. They're seeing the AI writing on the wall, and they know that this is the most salient issue as opposed to like issue number 10. This could potentially incentivize them to do something like invade Taiwan and then get rid of the US's chip advantage. And then they just rely on their own domestic production for AI chips. And that could give them an advantage economically in AI as well. So it's tricky. Right now, we have an advantage, but we also have a single source supply issue in Taiwan. So I think that would be... I don't know if the export controls destabilize the deterrence, but I think for building a destabilizing project, but I do think it has some complicated interactions with their incentives to invade Taiwan later on.
Yeah, you brought up one of my true hobby horses. Last time we spoke in San Francisco, I mentioned this to you, that it seems to me that the chip controls significantly reduce China's disincentive to invade Taiwan. Back when the semiconductor factories there were sending the highest end chips to China, there was more of a deterrent to invade, because one way or another, certainly any war that China was going to win is going to wind up with the factories disabled. China knows that. And so there was more of a disincentive before we cut off the flow of those chips to China. And it continues to bother me that pretty much nobody in the national security establishment talks about that. But to bring this back to your framing and, mutually assured malfunction, when you think about it, this is the natural thing for them to do, right? Because it's really easier than successfully sabotaging, our AI companies and all that. They're poised, they could invade Taiwan. They consider it part of China. Most of the world doesn't consider it a sovereign country for that matter. They would win in the long run, I think, militarily. It's a lot closer to them. They care about it a lot more. So again, these policies the U.S. is pursuing that have nearly universal assent in the national security establishment and the AI community, as far as I can tell, seem to me leading to naturally toward conflict of one kind or another. And I still don't quite see what I'm getting wrong here.
So... this is a good point. The paper, as I was sort of mentioning, had three parts to it. There's deterrence, nonproliferation, and competitiveness. Just like in the Cold War, there's deterrence through mutual assured destruction. There was nonproliferation for rogue actors so they don't get their hands on fissile materials, and containment of the Soviet Union. The nonproliferation part, and we talk about export controls a lot, and the nonproliferation part is primarily focused on rogue actors. I do mention that a more aggressive option would be to really tighten export controls in the competitiveness section, tighten export controls, turn the pain knob up. But that is depending on whether one is wanting to be more aggressive. I'm more uncertain about doing things like the main way in which I could see them turning the pain knob up is by going after the tools that are used to make the chips. They're smuggling those, and there are non-export controls on that, and that requires a lot of negotiation with the U.S.'s allies to try and freeze them out of that. I'm floating that as a thing one could do for competitiveness, but it would be a more aggressive option. And primarily emphasizing what are symmetric strategies. Non-proliferation is good for all responsible states. The deterrence thing is good for all responsible states. The competitiveness thing is a zero-sum thing. But to your point, I think I'll edit the paper to flag that this is an aggressive option, and I do comment on the Taiwan issue, but I'll maybe spell out more specifically, here's how, if you try and be really aggressive on chips, this could backfire quite substantially.
I think it is
a pretty reasonable option, though, for them, but I'm not necessarily advocating the most aggressive forms of all of these export controls, because I do think it starts to have some complicated effects on the dynamics between them.
Yeah, I mean, we should say we're actually recording this a little bit before the paper's released, and I'm going to hold this until after the paper's released.
Yeah.
If in the meantime you edit it so that my arguments no longer look like killer arguments, I will definitely file some kind of complaint with the highest authorities in podcast. So when the AI thing hit, and, Sam Altman testified before a Senate committee, everyone was saying, well, yeah, this definitely calls for international cooperation, international regulation, Altman was saying that, and so on. You don't talk much. I think I found an encouraging sentence or something. You don't talk much about the possibility of some kind of treaty. I mean, that's the alternative approach, right, with China. If you want, classically, with arms control, I mean, MAD was nice, but we also had arms control treaties, if only to address the sheer waste of continuing to make more and more nuclear weapons long past the point where mutually assured destruction was effective. Have you given up on that? You just think that would be nice. We get together, we talk, because you do talk about the need for transparency at some point. And I don't, well, I'll let you answer. Go ahead.
Yeah. Let me quickly walk to turn on the motion activated light for a second.
Okay, sure. Yeah. Sure. He's actually going to escape because my argument is I forgot about the portable earbuds.
I think there are three options. There is outcompete, there is make a deal, and there is prevent. I think the making a deal would first require that the states take this AI stuff much more seriously as the most salient issue. I think their immediate option would be to try and prevent each other. You would back any type of verification or some trust behind the treaty with some prospect of force. So otherwise it would be toothless. So I think that even a lot of treaties would still be backed by, and if you aren't going to keep your word, then we'll sabotage your project. I think that there's definitely a lot of room for coordination on non-proliferation to rogue actors. This is totally incentive compatible, and that I would read the things like the Biological Weapons Convention and the Chemical Weapons Convention in part that we don't want a poor man's atom bomb being available to a lot of irrational actors. And as a consequence, we need to prohibit that. And likewise, it would be a similar thing if we need to make sure we know where the AI chips are and make sure that they don't fall into the hands of rogue actors. So I think that's very incentive compatible. There are other things that are incentive compatible for coordination, such as a restriction on unsafeguarded AIs that have expert level virology capabilities for much the same motivations that there was the Biological Weapons Convention. And eventually they may want to coordinate more on stabilizing MAD, letting them get more and more capable AI systems, but not have any of their actions misread. So they might want to put out more information about this project is totally for economic purposes. We're not trying to, you know, we're not trying to build a superintelligence with this. So let us run this. I think that stuff could become compatible later, but I just imagine that takes a lot more time. So I haven't given up on it in the longer term. In fact, I think that one way out of this is this sort of, you know, a multilateral AI project done carefully with lots of countries as oversight. But in the shorter term, I don't think the main thing that will reduce the risk in the short term will be a treaty, because it'll just take way too long to ratify, and they have to be backed up in some way. They can't be toothless. The U.S. will just assume China's lying if they have no way of forcing them to behave otherwise. I think in the long term, it's more tractable. But in the short term, the states need to be willing to say, we're really going to make sure that you don't do that.
Let me ask you a question about kind of schools of thought within the AI safety community. I've been a little surprised. I've been a little surprised by just how rapidly kind of China hawkism generally has taken over American consciousness over the last few years. But I've also been a little surprised by how many people in the AI safety community, who I guess I just think of as like doves in some vague sense, I don't know, but who support the chip controls. I'm wondering if there's kind of two motivations for supporting them. You'd know better than I, but do some people support them not so much because they fear China or want to squash China's AI program per se, but because they're so worried about rapid takeoff that they're in favor of anything that constricts the profusion of microchips generally. Is that a school of thought?
So here's a charitable read on what people like Dario are thinking here for why they're wanting the export controls and also wanting to do an intelligence recursion or, you know, recursive loop that gets them to super intelligence that might lose control of it in the process and it gets everybody killed. Or maybe it enables them to take over the world and have a monopoly on power. One read is that they want the export controls because it makes there be a bit more of a gap between the US and China overall. Maybe it makes there be a 6-month gap. And this allows you to take that recursive loop that we'll just call that intelligence recursion or that recursion thing that brings you to super intelligence, the automated AI R&D loop. It lets you take that a bit slower and spend more compute and resources on guardrails. So maybe your risk tolerance at the max, if it's neck and neck, your risk tolerance, let's say, is 30% chance of loss of control with big error bars around that. If you have a larger lead over China, let's say 6 months or so, maybe your risk tolerance can be lower. Maybe you can act with like a 15% risk tolerance of getting everybody killed. And they're thinking, this is just the facts of the strategic situation. We're having to play Russian roulette, but let's play Russian roulette with one less bullet. And export controls would possibly let us play it with one less bullet. That's my charitable read on why they're supportive of that. I think that I would not like China having a decisive edge in economic competition over the course of this decade. The U.S. has basically one advantage, so them having more chips than China seems like a good idea. How exactly to do that strategically is a different question, or what's the right level of restrictiveness is a separate question. That's not coming out of we have to crush China and completely disempower them and make them accept all of our dictates. I just don't think that's tractable.
But economic dominance involves AI dominance is dominance, right? Because AI is involved. Well, let me just ask you again, why
it
is it
be an economic edge? But yeah, I mean, because they could, if it were too debilitating, I think they could, you know, attack some of those assets. That'd be obviously not read as rational, and that'd be, I think, much more aggressive than attacking a destabilizing AI project. I think China basically by default will dominate in other aspects of AI, like in energy, for instance, and potentially diffusion. So I think it's useful for the U.S. to shore up its edge in some way rather than not do anything to protect it.
Yeah.
But of course, you need to be prudent about these very complicated interactions or these complicated longer term effects in Taiwan.
So you just don't entertain the scenario that lots of people entertained, you know, 15, 20 years ago, where both countries prosper and you don't begrudge them their prosperity. You're both advancing economically and you manage to stay on sufficiently good terms, then it's not a threat to you that they're prospering economically. You don't see that as a possibility.
I do longer term. I think right now that's not their situation. But I think that if they are capturing the benefits from AI, they're not getting it, there's not omnicide in the process, and there's nobody trying to destroy each other. Omnicide, like extinction.
Oh yeah,
not genocide. Everybody dies. Yeah. If that doesn't happen in the process, then hopefully there could be some more a spirit of detente of them being less adversarial with each other. I think just by default, though, I couldn't say nothing about increasing competitiveness. And so I'd say, well, if you are trying to increase competitiveness in this zero sum situation, because that's just the structure they find themselves in the international scene, then here are things that one might consider or try and push for. But I think I think more important than competitiveness is survival, and survival of a state, I think, depends on deterrence and non-proliferation, deterring other actors from trying to crush them completely with the superintelligence, and making sure that rogue actors aren't getting their hands on some of these WMD-like capabilities or AI-enabled WMD-like capabilities.
Let me ask you a question that could make you some enemies in Silicon Valley, depending on how you answer it. I personally think that, I mean, people have noted that there is a dovetailing of interests between the desire by AI CEOs to have like zero regulation and maximal government support for energy production and so on, the dovetailing of that with fear of China. It helps them politically for everyone to be afraid of China. I actually don't think that that characterizes Dario personally, because I've kind of gone back and looked at things he said over the years. I think he's more ideologically driven, even though I think he's gravely and possibly catastrophically mistaken. I'm not cynical about him, but surely this plays some role in the China hawkism that is suddenly ascendant.
I mean, I certainly saying we have to crush China and whatnot, it would be to many actors as incentives to take aggressive, if they're selling more products, then it would be to their incentive to emphasize that threat. Some of them would do it for Machiavellian reasons, others for ideological reasons. And others would recognize that because it's the, I'll just ignore that little point, but
wisely. I mean, I would just say one approach to this is to compare what they've said over time, and I won't name any names. But
And I think some people are quite consistent on this. I don't view this paper as very hawkish. There, we're basically making fun of in some ways attempts to try and take over the world by building a super intelligence. At the same time, though, if states are looking to make themselves more competitive in this situation, then here are some AI relevant axes to do that on. But we try the paper is partly or mostly symmetric strategies. If China reads it, this makes them overall safer. If the U.S. Decision makers read this makes them overall safer. But there is the zero sum. So I think the deterrence and non-proliferation part is positive sum. I think the competitiveness part is zero sum, though.
Okay. By the way, do you have the sense that I think a lot of people have that the acceleration of AI progress is almost tangible right now?
I think it'll be more tangible. I think it's the main bottleneck for it is when we have AI agents scurrying around on computers and we're watching them do that, and this just is much more of a thing and people are actually doing this a lot, and that might happen this year, but that will communicate a lot of these advances, and so I think it will be much more salient of a topic later this year, but it's a continuum.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And do you have a take on DeepSeek on the model that got?
I think DeepSeek shows that restricting the capabilities of other countries or other superpowers, I should say, in their ability to make the cutting edge models, it seems to be pretty tough. Even if you had actually really tight export controls, my understanding was that the enforcement officers at the Bureau of Industry and Security in charge of the AI chip restrictions weren't particularly trying to enforce this and were directing their efforts toward other things. But let's say that China actually had far fewer chips. Then they'd probably just steal models. They could totally do that through some cyber attack.
For that matter, this process of distillation, using the input and output of existing reasoning models turns out to be a very efficient way to train a good reasoning model, right? And that seems to me just pretty much unstoppable. I mean, OpenAI can complain, but a lot of other people have done it with OpenAI models. And of course, OpenAI is not shy about taking people's intellectual property things. And I don't even think this is intellectual property. I don't even think this is illegal under existing law, right? So is it true as we're reading now, that's a very powerful way to follow up on an existing reasoning? By reasoning, I mean, not just an LLM, but this new generation, you know, O1, R1, so on.
Yeah, I think distillation has made it a lot easier for people with far fewer AI chips to just imitate the best model and then copy that functionality almost as well as the original model. So it substantially reduces the compute requirements if you can just imitate the models. And by default, I expect models to be out in the open and imitatable because people, the AI companies will need to be selling them and get revenue. So I'd expect other actors with reasonably sized GPU clusters to not necessarily stay that far behind. Mm-hmm. And if they do fall very far behind, then they'll steal.
Yeah. I don't know what your PDUM is, but given the statement that you that I cited at the outside about mitigating the risk of extinction, you're obviously concerned about AI. You're mm-hmm. very much involved in AI safety. I'm personally, you know, I'm still trying to think my way through the sci-fi scenario of AI takeover. I wish I could find a way to completely dismiss it, and I'm having trouble. But even that aside, I worry about the sheer velocity of change and the socially and geopolitically destabilizing nature of that. And mm-hmm. for that reason alone, I used to ask myself, maybe should open source be banned just because, I mean, there's a downside to it. There are upsides to open source as a way of keeping power from becoming too centralized. I recognize that. But if you're really concerned about the velocity of change, you might think open source should be banned. But as DeepSec illustrates, there's no way to do that without some kind of international agreement, right? And so that is one of the casualties of letting relations with China continue to deteriorate. Not that we're the only, you know, there's two players here and China's done, you know, a fair amount of antagonistic stuff. I recognize that. But are we not paying some price in the various kinds of regulatory coordination we could do with the ongoing antagonistic relationship with China?
So to your point about speed, I think it's right that there may be some risks that emerge that you only catch later. For instance, recently, actually, I don't know if I want this public at that time. Let me see how I could phrase it. For instance, we have an upcoming paper where we're seeing some of the very cutting edge models have pretty good virology wet lab skills, not just able to answer academic textbook types mm-hmm. of questions about virology, but I have a Petri dish. Here's a picture of it. What went wrong? I put it at this temperature. What should I do to fix it? That type of practical knowledge that can help guide a rogue actor step by step through a protocol to develop a bioweapon. Actually, for 3 out of 4 of the bioweapons tests that we ran, we were seeing that they were doing better than expert level virologists, and on the other one, they were roughly tied, slightly below, but nearly tied. And I've been watching this kind of closely, but not closely enough because I'm only now getting these results. So I think the industry will need to apply safeguards fast, and we will also need to think very carefully and possibly incentivize China not to release these sort of expert level or AI systems with expert level virology capabilities without reliable safeguards. And if you can't make open weight models have reliable safeguards, then that would be pretty, that would mean they couldn't be released. now there's a question of, is it expert level enough? Basically, pretty much any way we want to measure it, they're pretty capable, but maybe there's some bottleneck that we're not thinking of. But if it is the case that they're expert level in the relevant ways or soon to be, then we basically need an international discussion about mass proliferation of these capabilities for these similar reasons that the US and China coordinated on the Biological Weapons Convention.
I want to get back to Dario's approach. Again, this is the head of Anthropic, one of three big proprietary LLM companies in America, and just a big figure in the community for good reasons. He's done a lot. What he wants to use the leverage of AI dominance for is to make the world democratic, right? That's his explicit program, is that, we say to various countries, you want access to chips or whatever, you got to support democratic values and so on. And same with China. So what he's saying is he's going to demand regime change in China, basically, right? And to me, that should be almost self-evidently crazy. Regimes don't commit suicide. I mean, they may commit, you know, mutual suicide.
They might die, but
in the course of resisting regime change. But it seems to me that the way to use the leverage, if you're gonna amass the leverage, is to muscle everyone into a global regime of coordinated policy on AI, complete with like keeping bioweapons out of the picture and so on. Right? It seems to me that should obviously be the goal here. Would you at least agree that would be a good way to use the leverage? Should we ever decide to use it?
I mean, I think some of the coordination on non-proliferation and deterrence is, when states wake up to these threats, more totally incentive compatible. Hopefully once the discussion gets going, it is mainly, you know, negotiation of some of the particulars, right. But the overall thrust is easier. As far as regime change, yeah, I'm not advocating for trying to topple China, and like not because I think that the West has worse values. I'm not saying that I like Western values more, but I don't think that would work. I don't think that's a particularly good idea. That's been tried many times, and I think that the main route through which you would do that would be through building a superintelligence. But that itself is extraordinarily risky. I think you have to be not just a realist to argue for this. You have to be an offensive realist, and you have to say that the loss of control risk is fairly small for this to sound like a really good idea. And that China will sit by idly in the process. Like, I think you need like a large confluence of assumptions. China won't outcompete you. This won't be too escalating. They'll let you do it. We won't lose control. You need a conjunction of various things for this type of offensive strategy to make sense.
Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know if you remember, but when the AI thing first started heating up a couple of years ago, Mustafa Suleiman, who is now head of AI at Microsoft, was one of the co-founders of DeepMind, and Ian Bremmer published a piece in, I think, Foreign Affairs, where what they imagined, if I'm recalling correctly, was that the natural way to do this is that the U.S. and China get together, and they're the two dominant AI superpowers, and they collectively... coerce would be the impolite term, but collectively encourage other countries to comply with a global regime. And when the chip controls first started, I know that Mustafa Suleiman said, he conveyed on some podcast, he's a skeptic, but if we have the wisdom to use that as leverage to encourage cooperation with China on an AI regulatory regime, fine. I don't know what he's saying now, but
I don't think you need coercion for bioweapon capability restrictions.
Yeah, no, I know. You seem to be assuming that, well, it's in China's interest as a rational actor to constrain the proliferation of biological weapons capability. Absolutely true. But A, there's this type of weapon that's a little different as a last resort weapon, a variant of a biological weapon that, as a last resort, could make sense. But the other thing I'd say is geopolitics.
That's why I'm not pushing for trying to crush one of these superpowers.
The policies you favor are doing that, but maybe I'm wrong.
Is it particularly the export control, like pain knob on AI chips?
Yeah, it's the export control.
Yeah, and, I see. So I should say that for when making recommendations, it's primarily know where the AI chips are at robustly and make sure they're not falling into rogue actors' hands. There's a more aggressive option currently today, which would be restrict, something like the H20 chip. But as far as going all the way to export controls on semiconductor manufacturing tools and things like that, that's what would really be restricting their capabilities long term.
We're already there. Those are in place, right?
For comprehensively going after the tools, I don't think that I think that there are some, but there's a large supply chain for which this hasn't like been negotiated would take substantial effort. Mm-hmm. And I can flag that as a thing though, but I think that that does not seem as robustly good. I think that that's substantially more questionable. It's an idea with pretty ambiguous effects. I don't particularly push for that anymore. I think when I wasn't aware of the deterrence thing, then you know it would have been more of an option to buy more of a safety buffer if you are having to do some sort of race, intelligence explosion, and then hopefully you don't have to do it quite as recklessly. That I'm not advocating for that. Rather, for the export controls, the main thing is knowing reliably where the AI chips are at and making sure they're not going to rogue actors in particular.
Yeah. The other thing I was going to say quickly about, regulation of bioweapons being incentive compatible and China having just, self-interest to do it. I do think geopolitics is about more than rational acting. Emotions matter, not just in the sense that leaders like get pissed off if they think you're trying to strangle their economy, but in the sense that the domestic perception of that can constrain them. If once you've got your population convinced that there's this war on China, which I assume the Chinese population's well on its way to thinking that, then that actually constrains the leader himself or herself. There's a myth that autocratic leaders are immune from popular pressure. That's just not true. As Tom Friedman says, autocrats do more public opinion polling than anybody in the world. They're terrified of losing public support. So there is, I wouldn't overly rationalize my model of the world, but I think generically, if China thinks we're trying to strangle them and achieve AI dominant, overwhelming dominance. And again, super intelligent. Look, you tell me. I mean, if you've really got super intelligent, isn't the idea, it's not just military per se, it's not just economic per se. The idea is you can say, hey, go infiltrate Chinese social media and convince people that they should overthrow the regime. In principle, super intelligence could be that smart, right? You just let them mm-hmm. go, delegate that job.
Yeah, I mean, it's There are many ways it would disrupt the strategic picture, like completely. And like, if one has it and nobody else does, that would be just extraordinarily destabilizing.
Okay. As you know, last part of this conversation, like the last conversation I had with you, is for paid subscribers, Non-Zero Newsletter over time. We call it, and I think, we're not going to have, well, we still have some time for that. But first, I wanted to give you a chance because I feel I've kind of, forced this to, I've been maybe a little monomaniacal on the China issue.
I think it's a great point. I flag it as here's a much more aggressive option for competitiveness. And I mentioned competitiveness is zero sum, but I really emphasize the Taiwan thing, but I don't particularly connect it to here's how if you go extremely hard line on the export controls, this could increase China's incentive to invade Taiwan. I think I'd maybe say a sentence about that, but I can emphasize that a lot more.
And then I will become the fourth author on the paper. Eric Schmidt and I have never co-authored anything. I'm looking forward to this. But I want, before we go into overtime, I want to give you a chance because I've kind of confined our focus to just talk about what you think are the most important. The paper covers a lot of ground, you know, keeping the stuff out of hands of non-state actors and so on. So go ahead and tell us what you think is most important about it in other realms.
I mentioned other sorts of topics like an erosion of control. So with an erosion of control, that's where people continually cede more and more decision-making to AIs, and they do so fairly rapidly. They don't really have any choice because there's competitive pressures to do so economically or militarily. So economically, it's, well, this other competing company has these AIs running these programs now, and they're really fast. We have to if we're going to survive. So either we take ourselves out of the game or we align with this larger automation force and hand over more and more effective control to these AI systems. And this could ultimately lead to a situation where humans just have nominal control. And I've highlighted this argument in some years past in the paper. Sort of, we touch on this again and talk about some potential ways of mitigating this. One is obviously you need to make sure that you don't have autonomous independent AIs in the first place. I mean, that would, but once you have that, then you could try to model the relations in how much decision-making is put on the human versus on the AI through some legal demand that they have fiduciary obligations in the way that financial analysts or doctors or lawyers individuals having their services. So the fiduciaries need to keep their principals reasonably informed or get informed consent from them so that they're making some of the important decisions, but a lot of the low-level details can be left to the fiduciary. And then to avoid sliding into some weird equilibria where everybody was consenting along the way, but a frog was boiling and they weren't seeing the longer-term effects, you could have something like forecasting AI systems that are, when they're informing people, they're not just informing them what the immediate effects would be, but they are predicting what would happen in the longer term, what those effects would be. And that could prevent this sort of slide into a state that we can't really get out of, or a state that we would really not endorse by having fiduciary duties. And then the AI agents are helping us make the decisions much more prudent than they normally would be with humans. So I think there, so at least one thing in there is there's the problem of erosion of control. There are some potential answers based on law and based on some of the AI capabilities and their really tremendous abilities to forecast farther out than humans to exploit to mitigate that problem. But basically, for lots of the classic sorts of problems, we'll sort of weigh in on each of those. Like, for instance, what ethical policies should AIs follow? How should we embed ethics into them? Or what should those ethical principles be? And we're saying that you don't need to solve machine ethics. You can actually just add some basic constraints. Their attitude toward harm should be the attitudes that humans are legally required to have toward harm, which is not to foreseeably cause harm of the sort that winds you up in court, that is no torture crimes. Other sorts of things, like whether they are, you know, going to donate things or whether they, you know, support vegetarianism or whatnot, these you don't need to resolve, but you can need to have this basic restriction for their attitudes toward harm modeled after the law. So we're using it for these ethics discussions, using the law for that, and a lot of the other things are kept underdetermined and up to individuals to choose. But I could just keep going through, you know, random parts of the paper. We're trying to deal with, you know, these questions of I'm trying to think what's some other, like, I don't know, actually I have the paper right in front of me. Yeah, I mean, there's we touched on what to do about, like, open weights. What do you want to do about
open? What we should say to people, like, that's open source in the context, and it means you can just, anybody can copy the model.
Yeah, I mean, for open weights, I think that you could do a cost benefit analysis, but I think that the cost benefit analysis becomes extraordinarily clear when they have WMD-like capabilities. Proliferating WMD-like capabilities is just not something society can cope with.
So you can imagine a world in which you would favor trying to get an international ban on open weights, or what?
If they have expert level virology capabilities, for example, and they substantially help amateurs make bioweapons, then yeah, I don't think that would be a good thing to proliferate. In part because you can't defend. If it was defense dominant, that would be a different thing. If it's defense dominant, you want to proliferate as far and wide as possible. But if it's bioweapons are not defense dominant. If you spent like several billion on some more isolated place like Iceland, and you tried to make that be really secure to all viruses through a lot of filters and a lot of far UVC lighting, passively destroying viruses in the air. This really wouldn't help you against a well engineered virus. So I don't see a way that you can robustify the world to this. You could make it not like cause, you know, kill everyone. I think that's more tractable. But causing hundreds of millions plus of deaths, I don't see a way to prevent that with anything in sight. It looks very offense dominant. But all these WMDs are offense dominant.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess we will head into overtime. I mean, first I want to also give you a chance to tell people where they should go to find the stuff of yours you consider most important. I mean, again, the name of the report itself is Superintelligence Strategy, the name of the paper you just released.
If you do superintelligence.ai, I think that
AI. Really work. So that's where they download it. Okay. Mm-hmm. And your other stuff, you know, Center for AI Safety. You're on Twitter, right? At what's your Twitter
name? A bit, yeah.
Yeah. Not super active, but what is it? Is it just at Dan Hendricks?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
H-E-N-D-R-Y-C-K-S.
C-K-S.
Yeah, no relation to Jimmy then. I'm not the first, probably.
Yeah, you're not the first.
Sorry, it's on my brain because I just saw it. Never mind, a documentary about this stuff. But anyway, you've done a lot of work in a lot of important areas, and so people should definitely check it out. You know, ranging from, again, like alignment questions, deep research problems associated with alignment to AI safety in other senses, like the ones this paper addresses. So now, again, anybody who's a paid subscriber to the Non-Zero Newsletter can follow us into Overtime, and we thank everybody who's followed us this far.